So I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Ian Forsyth. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Bruce.
Ian, last Sunday I was privileged enough to attend the launch of your latest book, A Hazardous Port, at the Maritime Museum in Fremantle. Big crowd turned up and it was a lovely opportunity for people to meet one another and to get to hear about your book. Perhaps you could just start by telling me what it was that prompted you to write such a book.
Thank you. The origins of the book go back to about 10 years when my brother Ron Forsyth and I wrote a biography of our great-grandfather, George Forsyth, who was an early harbour master in Fremantle. In the course of that writing, I did a lot of research on the history, politics, social circumstances of the colony of Western Australia. And at the end of having done that, so much work that wasn't used, I thought that it might be an idea to write another book. Yeah. Then there were three things that in fact really prompted me to do so. The first one was that I was really looking at the time for a book that covered the whole early history of the colony from the time of its discovery by the Dutch in the 17th century to the settlement by the British in 1829, and then through the operation of the colony during its colonial period to 1901. I could find no book that really did that. There's some earlier books, but there'd been a lot of research done since then, but nobody seemed to me to have pulled it together in one volume.
So you were basically filling in some gaps.
Gaps, yeah, that's right. And the second gap was
when you're talking about gaps, it's like there's been an emphasis, in my understanding, on Captain Cook and the East Coast, and you've been based in Canberra for a lot of your working life, so I would imagine that you've picked up that in the course of your own reading.
Yes, that was the second factor. I did do a lot of reading on Australia's colonial history, and it has struck me for some time that the West Australia story gets short shrift in accounts of Australian history, and that was something I wanted to try and remedy as well. And then the third factor was that I wanted to put a maritime perspective on that early colonial history, and it struck me that the Port of Fremantle, the story of the Port of Fremantle, was as a good focus to do that. As you know, the impression of the West Australian economy in the East is essentially that we're a land of pitiful sand grapers. Well, I argue, I hope this comes through strongly in my book, that we were first and foremost a maritime outposts that had to be kept afloat in terribly dangerous oceans and seas and a tricky river by very struggling mariners.
Yes, and of course, your connection with Fremantle, even though you've lived the majority of your life in Canberra, your family connection with Fremantle is very strong, because there's not only your great-grandfather George Forsyth, who was intimately involved as a harbour master, but also, as I understand, that there are a lot of other relatives who have a connection with the state.
Yes, and this is something that I didn't know until I started writing the first book with Ron. Mm. But yeah, we've got a convict there. Mm-hmm. We've got a mayor there, a businessman. It's quite extensive.
And I suppose allied with that family history, because, as you know, I've been interested in family history and have written extensively about my own branches of the family. When you start to explore the family and then you look at the backdrop of the kind of cultural conditions, the political and economic conditions, and that fills in a lot of the
exactly, the
gaps of that nature.
That's right. My research is really trying to give context to George's particular story,
yes,
and that's what got me reignited my interest in in the history,
yeah,
which I'd forgotten virtually all of it by that when I started.
Mm. Mm. Well, you've certainly in your book, and I've obviously had a hand in it because I was helping you a little bit with the proofreading of that, and you've certainly
I was more than proofreading. Thank you very much.
You've covered a lot of ground, and it's going to be really interesting, I think, for a lot of people to read this book and to educate themselves about what's happened in Western Australia, because I share your view that it's been a very neglected emphasis, if you like, both in history courses and certainly for the wider public to understand. Yeah. Yes. Can you kind of outline some of the themes that began to emerge as you wrote the book?
Yeah, and this I was particularly interested in trying to develop some broad themes, and I thought that might be one advantage of bringing the whole history together rather than treating it, as most historians tend to do, by issues or particular eras of history. The first theme that sort of permeates that whole 300 years of history is the isolation of the port. Mm-hmm. That'll come of no surprise. I mean, it was redolent of Geoffrey Blainey's description of New South Wales, his notion of the tyranny of distance. Well, that was certainly a factor here. Mm. The whole colony was, of course, totally dependent on its port and its links with the rest of the world, and indeed even the eastern states. The second one was that how Fremantle was just carrying on from that. It became the existential heart of the colony, effectively, and also the commercial centre of the colony. And that's one reason why I think it provides such a useful and insightful focus to tell the colony story. The third one was it was one of challenge. The whole story is challenges and difficulties right throughout.
Yeah.
And how it led to more grief than glory.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, through persistence and a lot of hard work, the colony and the port was positioned to become the gateway for the nation of the Western Gateway for the nation of Australia when it came into existence on the 1st of January 1901.
When you talk about challenge, you're talking from a number of perspectives. It was an economic challenge, it was a physical challenge in terms of eventually what became a deep water port. So there were multiple challenges for those early explorers and colonists.
And the biggest challenge of them all probably was in fact that they didn't have a port. For all of its colonial period, it was really a port of necessity rather than merit.
Can you just describe where ships anchored and what the challenges for everyday mariners were like for the bulk of that period?
The port in fact had to operate from four anchorages in the early days, and the problem was each of those had their issues in terms of access. The best and most obvious one, of course, was within the estuary of the Swan River, that was blocked by the bar, which they called in those days the Monkey Rock, plus a lot of shoaling on the outside and inside of the bar. Stirling advised his authorities that could be easily removed, or alternatively they could cut a canal into the estuary. That was perhaps one of his biggest mistakes in terms of his judgments of the area, and there were many. And in fact, it was not until the last few years that the colony's existence had achieved that. So there were only very small boats
could go up the river,
get up there, and that was difficult as well.
Mm.
So ships had to anchor somewhere off the coast. The most obvious anchorage, the closest one, of course, was Gage Roads. But that was open to the nor'westers, storms in particular.
Yep. So Gage Roads was protected from more the south and the southwest, but not so much from the north?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Then if they were lucky to know when storms were coming, they could take boats of a particular size into either Owen's Anchorage across the Success Bank, or into Coburn Sound, which was a very fine harbour, but getting to that was very difficult. They had to go through the Challenger Passage, just to the north of Garden Island. That was a very tricky passage. So you had those were the anchorages. Now the storms were primarily in the winter, but not completely. I've done an analysis of where most of the shipwrecks and other serious maritime accidents occurred and when they occurred. And I think it was roughly 2/3 of them occurred in the winter months, but there was still a lot outside that period.
Yep.
And lost my thought there.
When we're talking about ships, are you talking now about the period when the British started to show an interest, or are you talking about the Dutch and Portuguese? I was
talking there primarily about the colonial period. But the Dutch, of course, had their own problems.
Yes.
And in fact, the challenges that the port faced in its colonial period were really all portended by the Dutch and even the French experience in the area.
Yes.
Well, the Dutch had 4, maybe 5 shipwrecks on that coast. Virtually all of the ships that did hit the coast or came near to hitting the coast did so in stormy weather. They couldn't reach the shore comfortably. It was de Houtman and de Delde who first saw the area of Fremantle, for example, in 1619. They tried several times to reach the shore, but couldn't do so.
So it goes back, this maritime history, to the early 17th century. And in that time, different nationalities showed an interest, but clearly the biggest impediment to having a permanent settlement was trying to find safe anchorage all along that western coast. Line.
Exactly.
Would I be right?
That's right. And Stirling thought he had found that. And when he did his reconnaissance of the area in March 1827, he did so in what was, as you'd know, one of the best months of the weather here. He didn't see a storm, unlike all the Dutch and the French. Just coming briefly back to the French, Jacques Hamelin, who was the 2IC of Baudin's expedition to the South Seas in 1801 to 1803, he spent a couple of weeks in the area, the same as de Vlaeminck had with the Dutch in 1697. And he had to take refuge from storms here. And in fact, one of his boats was smashed on the beach around Cottesloe. So his reports, like those of the Vlaeminck of the area, were very underwhelming and sort of did nothing to excite any interest in settlement here. Now, Stirling, when he came, he would have known that the first thing he had to find was a good port. He was, in a sense, competing with the possibility of setting up the settlement at King George Sound, now Albany, which of course has a magnificent harbour.
I'll come back to that because I've got a question about that.
So in a sense, Stirling was lucky that he didn't experience a storm and have to report on that, because otherwise his report to these authorities,
the history might have been a little different.
Would have been very difficult. And he was very evangelical, of course. I mean, when he arrived with really a burning ambition that he would lead the establishment of the colony here.
Now, let's look at motivation. What was happening then? There was a lot of exploration by various European nations, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French and the British, you know, as far as this coast is concerned anyway. Was there a kind of an ethos of curiosity, scientific exploration, driving that more than a political agenda, or was there a combination?
There was a combination, but after the Dutch lost interest in the area, and that was effectively after de Vlaeminck explored the Swan River. And part of his mission, incidentally, was to try and find a transit port between Cape Town and their regional headquarters in Batavia.
Batavia. Yeah.
That's why his report, damning report of this area, was so significant at that time. There was then a lacuna of another 60, 70 years before much happened here. And what happened was really in the Pacific Ocean. The next phase shifted the Pacific Ocean, trying to find the Great Southland, the mythical Great Southland, and also the East Coast that had to exist somewhere of New Holland, as had been mapped to that time, in particular by Abel Tasman. So a lot of those expeditions, in fact, came around Cape Horn.
Yep.
Rather than Cape of Good Hope, as the Dutch had done. And they had an absolutely massive ocean to explore. Now, interestingly, the French sent 11 grand expeditions to the area in the period 1763, just after the end of the French-British Seven Years' War, through to 1829. The establishment of the colony of, or the Swan River settlement.
Wasn't young Napoleon Bonaparte?
Yes, well, there's a very interesting anecdote there, one amongst many. Napoleon Bonaparte, when he was a 16-year-old lad, applied to join La Perouse's expedition. And La Perouse spent, I think, it was 3 months or so in Sydney, and then headed off, and he was never seen or heard of again. And they subsequently found he had been shipwrecked.
Napoleon was
rejected.
He never got on the boat.
Now, I mean, that's one of the biggest
what ifs
of history. That's enough to blow your mind for a few months.
But, yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, these are some of the themes that run throughout your book that I found really fascinating about it. And I mean, we could go on and on into the actual build-up, but let's fast forward and bring us to the British interest. Now, as you know, of course, there were penal colonies set up on the East Coast, Tasmania, and in Sydney itself. Was there any talk about a penal colony in the early 19th century in Western Australia?
No. The concept of penal colonies was really waning then. There was, throughout that century, the French had some interest in it, but it was very controversial. And Baudin and Dumont de Ville, who explored the area in 1826, they were both very negative on this concept. It did in fact happen, but much later. The French didn't claim or settle anywhere in the continent of Australia until, I think it was 1854 from memory, when they established New Caledonia as a penal settlement. And that had a terrible history.
Was that because there was more of a kind of a humanist thinking permeating the Enlightenment?
Yes, that was one element of that. In fact, it was also around the time of the Romantic movement, where in France in particular, they were looking for a paradise on earth in the South Pacific. It's a notion that it was a fad. It didn't last long, because around about the same time, one of their expeditions led by Dufresne was Dufresne and 22 or so of his men were captured by the Maoris and eaten. And then Bougainville had clashes in the South Pacific.
The French had a lot of bad luck in terms of their endings, didn't they?
Extraordinarily bad luck. And this is one thing I don't think is fully appreciated in France, let alone Australia.
Okay.
But we make a lot of that Captain Cook, of course, was slain in 1779 on his third expedition. And he... But the French, I mentioned, had sent 11 expeditions to the South Seas in that period. Of those, the commanders of those expeditions, 9 did not make it back. And some of them, such as Dufresne,
that's a fair old attrition rate, isn't it?
It's extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary. And, but I should, coming back to your very original question about was this science or more to it than that. The French, this is a controversial issue, but I think that they were primarily scientific in nature. They were, most of them had lots of so-called scientists on board. Baudin's expedition was at one point likened to a floating zoo. He had many people with expertise in particular areas, scientific areas on board.
Yes, interrupt. One of the things that crossed my mind, of course, is that, and this goes, and I'll ask you a little bit later on about the challenges in researching a book such as this, trying to find the papers, the records of motivation that aren't always necessarily existing or available, in trying to work out. And you've done, I think, a wonderful job in trying to pick back through whatever is available and then speculate about where motivation, whether it was politically driven under the guise of a scientific expedition or whether it was the other way around, perhaps.
I hope I've been rigorous in being clear as to what is based on documented evidence and what is on hypothesis and supposition. There's a lot of, because there's so many gaps in the historical records, particularly in terms of motivation for some of the decisions that were made at the time, there is a lot of speculation about this. In particular, even today, there's books being written on France's motivation, and again, this thesis keeps popping up that there was a race between the French and the British to get beachhead around Sydney Cove.
But it's not clear.
It's not clear, and that's not a theory I buy into, frankly.
Yeah.
But that's a long story.
Yeah. What about we move to the Stirling's arrived, Captain Freemantle's here, there's a fledgling colony, Swan River Colony, that's getting off the ground. The port, or lack of it, is the major challenge. Now, from what I've read in your book, there were arguments to and fro, there were all sorts of possibilities put up in those early years and right through most of the 19th century. And I think one of your underlining themes is that the British government were very slow to fund proper exploration and infrastructures, and that was a major inhibiting factor. Can you enlarge on that?
I think this, I've subsequently learnt in fact that I came to the conclusion that their model of colonisation in Western Australia had serious flaws, and that their governance of the colony had serious flaws, and I wrote that it wasn't one of their finest experiences in colonisation. I've subsequently learnt, in fact, that it was not unique in that respect.
Okay.
I mean, they really had no model of empire. It was a lot of ad hocery. A lot of it was pressed by private business rather than the government. They didn't have budgets for this. It wasn't a priority. They didn't have a coherent policy. They had many actors involved in the decision, from the Prime Minister down to the Minister of War and Secretary of War and Colonies. But they didn't even have a seat in cabinet. The Colonial Office didn't have a seat in cabinet until about 1854. So it was basically establishing a colony on the cheap.
Yeah, and when you talk about ad hocery, there was no established chain of command, if you like, in terms of how decisions were made and who had the say. And it was kind of somebody would come in with a proposition, they'd get the ear of a particular, perhaps parliamentarian, and they'd go with that for a while, and then it could, just like ships, it would change course.
Change in the night, yes.
Very, very quickly.
Yes.
They're here, the colony's getting off the ground. There were, many submissions from the colony? Was it through Stirling?
Yes, indeed there were. It was
going back
almost,
to London?
Almost constantly.
Yeah.
No, they didn't go back to London. The submissions to improve the port didn't go back to London. The governor, local governors, had the authority to do that. which subject to them not costing London any money, and with an assumption they couldn't borrow money either. They had to get London's approval for money. Yeah. And that was, I think, the working assumption was that they wouldn't get that. Okay. So they were left to their own resources. In fact, until the colony was established as a penal establishment, most of the infrastructure was developed by the private sector.
Yes, yeah, so we're talking
particularly
now
the port.
We're talking now the first 20 plus years of the colony
first
until 1850s when convicts started to arrive.
That's right.
Was it recognised very early on that they needed a labour force?
Oh, I think so. Yes. Yeah. I mean that was a real big gap.
Yeah.
Not only a labour force, but a cheap labour force.
A cheap labour force, and also I presume, if they're having to raise their own funds, they needed to produce something to actually have money to
and
have something to barter with or trade with.
Yes. Yeah. And their first exports did not happen until I think it was 1838.
Okay.
And that was just one shipment. It took a long time for them to build up and actually earn income from that.
Mm.
Again, another constraint.
Another constraint. Mm.
Coming back to your question about inquiries, there were, in the period 1829 to 1892, 12 sets of official inquiries into how to develop a safer and more efficient port. Then on top of that, there were dozens of proposals coming through from would-be experts of various quality, which the government had to heed. In fact, none of the key recommendations of any of those reports, apart from the one by C.Y. O'Connor in 1892, which I'm sure we'll come back to, none of the key recommendations were adopted by the governments of the time, and where the pressure was such that they simply had to do something, the solution was basically to extend one of the jetties or build another jetty, which was very suboptimal.
One of the things that, as you're speaking, it reminds me that you go into quite clearly and thoroughly in the book is that the local colony didn't take long to begin having newsletters, news sheets, newspapers, and the actual debates that were very full on. I mean, there would be defamation actions flying all over the place these days if any of the sort of exchanges were reproduced in contemporary Australia.
Yes.
But there was a very intense debate going on for many, many decades, where, as you say, wannabe experts who had no necessary background in these areas of how to make a port were having their say based on their own observations, experience and ideas, and perhaps their commercial interests as well.
Yes.
So everybody would throw their hat into the ring, and there were profound disagreements, which must have made it even more difficult in decision-making circles to fasten on something that would actually work.
Yes, exactly. I think the governments were basically bamboozled by the issues involved, but that you're right that the there was a lot of newspapers right from almost the first 6 months on, and they're very, very interesting, and in fact this has been a very good source of new information for me in this book. I spent a lot of time on Trove, the National Library's research engine, which is brilliant.
A wonderful resource.
It is brilliant. Yeah. And, of course, we didn't have universities and students writing theses at that time, but you did have the newspaper reports. You obviously had to read them carefully and understand the politics. For example, the Fremantle Herald was run by former convicts, and they were not exactly pro the government. And indeed, at one point, Governor Weld refused to send the antagonistic reports, particularly from this newspaper, back to London. And he was, in fact, chastised by London for that.
For doing that.
But there's a lot of wonderful writing, colourful writing on the colony at that time.
And much of it, of course, it was prompted by the scale of human tragedy, because there were ships getting wrecked, there were people being lost, there were all sorts of calamities. I mean, we didn't have vehicles on the road and traffic accidents to report on, but we had shipwrecks.
Indeed.
And maritime incidents, yeah, as they were called, which were often very serious.
Indeed. Well, I have accounted for 88 wrecks just in the area of the port alone. Mm-hmm. That's the larger port, sort of from beyond the Rottnest Garden Islands, etc. Mm. 88 in that period, which is over one a year. Mm. Can you imagine one jumbo jet or a jet going down in Perth one a year?
What that would happen.
Then on top of that, there was about another 80 very serious maritime accidents. Mm. And so I've looked at these, including the location, the timing, the sizes of the ship, and the basic circumstances, and also looked at what the implications were of many of those accidents for the operations of the port. Mm. And they did learn a lot about the port through these accidents.
Through that.
Because particularly from, I think it would have been the 1860s on, when there was a significant accident, they had to have an official inquiry into it. Mm. And a lot was learnt through those inquiries.
Yeah, and it's hard, I think, for us in contemporary times to envisage what it must have been like, but you can probably describe a ship would come in with cargo and with passengers and with crew, and it would pull up at the anchor somewhere, Gage Roads, and basically at that point, what would happen?
They would usually be brought in by piloted in around Rottnest Island, anchored, and then would have to get lighters to take them to one of the jetties.
A lighter,
just a small boat that would carry the cargo, fairly flat bottom, so it could dock against their little jetties, which for most of the period didn't stretch into much more than 11 feet of water.
Where was the little jetty stationed in relation to today? Do you, describe?
The first one was on South Beach, which the first two were private jetties that were owned and developed by Daniel Scott, who was the second harbour master. He was a part-time harbour master, very entrepreneurial, and this is one of the early businesses he got into, which got him into a bit of conflict of interest.
We were only talking earlier today about Scott Street in Fremantle.
Yes, that's right. That's Scott. And the Harbour Master Restaurant in the Esplanade Hotel, which is named after Scott.
Yeah. So that was quite a feat for actually to firstly have safe anchorage.
Yes.
To get all the cargo and also the passengers ashore.
Yes. And then if there was if they knew a storm was approaching, they had to get into Owen's Anchorage or into Coburn Sound. Mm. Now, that you could only take ships with a draft of less than 16 feet into bus to get across either the Success Bank into Owen's Anchorage or through the Challenger Passage into Coburn Sound. Fortunately, up until the convict period, or after the first 18 months, which were really calamitous for shipping, but between that time and the time of the convict ships arrives, most of the ships that came to the port were smaller, up to 16 feet, and then, they could get into those.
Fast forward a bit again, we get on and we've got steamships and all sorts of different vessels that are coming, and that's compounding the problem.
Exactly. Just before getting out of that, I was surprised that of the convict ships, the bigger ships, there's only one of, I've forgotten the number now, but 30-odd ships that brought convicts here, only one of them got into trouble. That's amazing. Although at the end of that period, the harbour master got into trouble, Harbour Master Harding. He and three of his crew, in fact, were drowned going to the assistance of a ship in a storm in Gage.
Risky for everybody. Risky for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. But the steamship, the advent of ships of sail and steam, which started from the early 1870s, did put a lot of pressure on the government to find a new, safer, more accessible port.
And what was it then that heralded or presaged the breakthrough? In the 1890s?
A couple of things came together. Firstly, you had the gold rush around that time, which really demanded that something be done, but it also provided the resources for something to be done, the wealth, and the capacity to borrow.
Yes.
At the same time, the colony was granted responsible government in 1890, which meant they then had greater control over their budget. They could borrow money.
Mm.
The third big factor of the time was that the first treasurer premier of the colony, John Forrest, appointed a brilliant chief engineer, C.Y. O'Connor, who was a man of, as I'm sure most people in Fremantle would know, an extraordinary man who cut through all the rubbish that had been served up in some of the previous reports and that had been bamboozling politicians for so long. He convinced Forrest of his scheme to create a harbour, in an inner harbour in the estuary of the Swan River. And he did so against considerable opposition and competition with other ideas, including by the Great Britain's maritime engineering consultant, Sir John Coode, who had done several reports for the governments, and who was held in very, very high esteem in some quarters of the colony.
So finally, all the stars aligned. And we've now got, as a result of that, for the last 125 years or so, we have a deep harbour in Fremantle.
Yes.
It took 100 years, the best part of 100 years, for that to happen.
Yeah.
And the history that you've managed to weave into this story, and it indeed shows what a hazardous port Fremantle was. It also shows, and if I could take from your title of your previous book, A Hazardous Life, which referred specifically to your great-grandfather, George Forsyth, but it also was a hazard of life for anybody who might have actually come to Australia, or to the West Coast anyway, without a port. One closing question, because I'm conscious that we need to wind this up soon. Was there any serious interest in the early days when it became apparent that this was not a great anchorage to instead set up what's now Western Australia's capital instead of at Perth at Albany that had a beautiful harbour and has a beautiful harbour?
Yeah. Well, in fact, that option was considered around the time they decided to set up the colony here. Of course, Major Lockyer had, at the time, Stirling did his reconnaissance in 1826. Lockyer was establishing his little garrison down at King George Sound. And in fact, Stirling, on his way back to Sydney, having completed his reconnaissance, picked up Lockyer.
Uh-huh.
Now, Lockyer was, of course, much keener on something happening at Albany. And he, in fact, wrote around that time, he put forward submissions saying that any settlement around the Swan River was going to be very, very difficult and that it would need to use the port of King George Sound for shipping. Mm. And in fact, that was prescient. Mm. That was the case until the end of the 1800s. Mm. All the steamships, the mailers, for example, the timetable services, all pulled into Albany rather than into Fremantle. Fremantle was simply too dangerous for them. Mm. They weren't prepared to take the risk. So and in fact, it wasn't until 1901 that the first mail service came, British mail service came into the Fremantle port. But then even as late as early 1870s, one of the reports that was done for Governor Weld, who at that time was looking for justification to move the port to Cockburn Sound, and this was in the context of pressure of the arrival of steamships, that report recommended, in fact, the bottom line was that they shift the port down to Albany.
Well, that's another big what if, isn't it? C.Y. O'Connor and his brilliance, and you know, he's had a very, he's very fresh in the memories of many Australians and some people we know who are related or descendants of him. Had that not happened, then who knows what the history would have been. But I think your book, Ian, just to conclude, really captures the adventure, the excitement, the devastation, the difficulties of all of the aspects that surround the Port of Fremantle. And I'm sure that any listener to this podcast who has that shared interest will find it fascinating. Now, just tell me, in closing, where can they obtain this book if people want to buy it?
It's just starting to go on sale in the key bookshops in Fremantle.
Okay.
We'll eventually move to Perth, but any of the bookshops in Fremantle will stop.
So people can make their inquiries and get a copy of
it. It's $45 for a copy, over 400 pages. And
well, having seen it and seen the beautiful charts, the photographs and the actual content of it, I could thoroughly recommend it. So thank you very much for talking to Fremantle Shipping News this morning.
Thanks, Bruce. Been a pleasure.